Hello and welcome to episode 434 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson and with me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Be LSAT famous. You can share news and ask questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. You're going to have a double black diamond, Nathan, on Wednesday, January 24th at 9 p.m. Eastern. That sounds like that's for everyone.
That's for everybody. Yeah, that's going to be a free version of our expert level logical reasoning class that we teach at. I teach it every other week or sometimes every week. It depends on demand for it. I'm really excited to have everybody come and hang out while we do a whole bunch of hard-ish logical reasoning questions. If you want to register for my Double Black Diamond class on January 24th, that's again 9 p.m. Eastern, just go to lsat.link/free if you want to sign up for that free Double Black Diamond class.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, yeah, today is Christmas. Tomorrow is December 26th. That's going to be the registration deadline for the February 2024 LSAT. Yeah, sign up for that if you are ready.
We're only ever going to ask you for one favor on this show. And the favor that I would like to ask you today is to please just hit the subscribe button. It doesn't cost you anything, but wherever you listen to this podcast, if you hit subscribe, it really helps the algorithms understand that our content is valuable. So if you listen to this show regularly, why not subscribe? If you like what we're doing here and you want to support the show, it's an easy thing that you can do to just hit that subscribe button. And we will really appreciate it.
Let's jump in. So this first one's from Anonymous. The subject is family pressure to apply this cycle.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I have taken two official LSATs and scored in high 160s. I've improved and have been PTing in the mid 170s. I hope to retake in January or February if necessary. I really want to do well on the LSAT because I am a splitter. I had a life-threatening medical condition in college that lasted for years. I was in the hospital a lot. That took me from a straight A student to a 3.5 GPA. I am a STEM major. I'm frustrated with and very ashamed of myself for my bad GPA because I love school. I see the LSAT as an opportunity to overcome my past. However, my parents are pressuring me to apply this current cycle. I am financially dependent upon them and I live at home. I've been applying to as many jobs as I possibly can so I can make my own choice on when to apply. Job searching has been fruitless and I feel like I have no option but to apply this cycle. So I have been racing to get my personal statement done. I've even tried explaining the LSAT / scholarship potential to my parents. Any advice? Producer Eric helpfully dug up our link to LSAT Demon Parents Night. That's a class that I taught earlier this year. And it's advice for parents on like how you should be, how they can be supporting you. And it is, yeah, I think it's pretty much a lengthy lecture on, hey, here's how the money works. Do you care about how much money your kid's going to have to pay for college? Or sorry, how much money your kid's going to have to pay for law school, or how much money you're going to have to pay for your kid to go to law school? And if you care about tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars, then you need to familiarize yourself with the way the law school scholarship game works. So maybe that Parents Night video would be helpful for your parents, Anonymous.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just saving money, right, on law school. We've mentioned this hundreds of times before, but when you go to law school for free or very close to it, that means you're much more likely to be in the top of your class, which means you're much more likely to get good grades and have good job opportunities after you leave law school. So it's not just about saving money in the short run.
Yeah. If you're, I mean, you're PTing in the mid 170s, which is great, but you're not taking the LSAT. You're retaking the LSAT in January or February. And at that point, you might as well just be taking it in April or June or, you know, and then just apply at the beginning of the next cycle. You're already so late for this cycle by the time those January, February test scores come out, you're just going to be behind like at least one wave of admission offers. And those admission offers have like hundreds of thousands of dollars of scholarship, millions of dollars of scholarships attached to them. Why do you want to try to apply at that point? Why wouldn't you apply at the beginning of the cycle? Just wait six more months. I mean, maybe you can sell it to your parents that way. It's like, hey, look, I'll be applying in September of this year, 2024.
Yep. Yeah.
Right? Because otherwise you're going to apply in March of 2024. So just tell them, yeah, mom and dad, I'm going to apply in September of 2024 because that's going to help me get my best LSAT for sure. My application will be ready to go on the first day of the application cycle. And then I'll just sit back and let the offers roll in. That's really the way we'd like to see you do it.
Yeah. Good luck. Let us know what they say. This next one is from Nate. The subject is combating frustration on the LSAT. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I'm a current Demon Premium subscriber, and I have been studying for the LSAT with the Demon since the fall of 2022. Just over a year in, I have improved from a 141 diagnostic to a 161 with my practice tests. Okay, I took the June 2023 LSAT scoring a 158, but have higher aspirations. Since June, my studies have yielded less progress than I have been hoping, only marginal improvements in LR and RC. I took a short break in August when I had to move, but I have been trying to get an hour of study every day since. Okay, my first thought there is if you're not making progress and you're doing only an hour, maybe you need to do more. But anyways, when I do sections and score lower than when I was scoring months ago, I cannot help but feel frustrated. Am I doing too little, too much? With my goal being the 170s, what would you suggest to be effective strategies to not feeling so frustrated? I want my score. I believe in myself, knowing that I can get there. When I study, I don't feel that confidence. Any advice? Thank you.
It says that Nate is trying to study. I've been trying to get an hour of study every day since. Trying to get an hour of study every day is not the same thing as doing an hour of study every day. We do emphasize 1 hour LSAT a lot with our LSAT Demon students, which is if you give me a high quality hour consistently every day, then I'm confident that you're going to make progress. I don't think Nate has been giving me that hour consistently every day. I don't think Nate needs to try for hour number two. I think Nate needs to make sure he's doing hour number one. I don't see how you could possibly study for an hour every day since June and not make dramatic progress. I mean, over a year, Nate has made a 20-point improvement, I should say, like 141 to 161 already. That's great. But if you want faster progress, you can continue to make progress. But you're going to need to do more than, you're going to need to get that hour every single day and potentially do more than that. The other advice that I would want to give Nate is that Nate says he's made only marginal improvements in LR and RC. If that means that Nate is now like crushing the games, hopefully, then Nate, you really need to get it. You need to get moving, because if games is your best section of the test is going to disappear after June of 2024. So Nate's got, you know, he doesn't say anything about when he's retaking. I don't know why he took the test in June of 2023. I mean, that was premature, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't ready. He's like, he's not happy with it looks like the highest he scored is 161. He took the June 2023 LSAT and got a 158. I mean, that's like right in your range. If you're not happy with that, then you're not happy with your range, which means you should have not taken the test in the first place, right? You've got a goal in the 170s. Well, then don't take the test again until your practice tests show that you're in the 170s. But I want to stress, Nate, that you've got January, February, April, and June. There are 4 more chances at taking the LSAT with Logic Games. And after that, the test is going to get harder for you because they're going to replace games with an additional section of LR. Anything else for Nate?
Yeah, one thing that Nate says here is, when I do sections and score lower than I was scoring months ago, I cannot help but feel frustrated. There is some sense here, Nate, that you may not be doing this, but there is this possibility that you're taking sections to see where you're scoring as opposed to learn from them.
And you should be frustrated
on
every mistake, right? I mean, you should you should be drilling logical reasoning, and you should be upset about every single mistake. You should be forcing yourself to get every question that you do in the drilling right. And that's impossible because the drilling is going to give you harder and harder questions. But then you're going to be improving if you do that, if you insist on getting them right. But if you sit down and just hammer a full section and, you know, let's say try to finish it when you really shouldn't be finishing it in the low 160s, high 150s, I mean, there's no way you should be finishing sections at that level. And but if that's what you're doing, if you're like, well, but let me try a section here, I want to see how many points I get, then you're just not taking individual questions seriously enough. And if you don't take individual questions seriously enough, then you're not going to get the results you want. So I agree. Yeah, don't do so many timed sections that you're not reviewing your mistakes.
Yeah, that should be your hyper focus.
Reviewing is where the improvement comes from. I mean, that's what we really want you to do. That's why we hammer on drilling so much, because we want you to do one question and then stop immediately if you miss it. Or stop immediately if you struggle with it. If you get it right, but you're not exactly sure why, read the written explanations, watch the videos, use the ask button, talk to our team of tutors. There's so much that you can do in the Demon to review, to like get the squeeze the maximum learning out of each one of those mistakes. And then that should feel good, because you'll feel like, oh, that question was totally frustrating, but now I see, right? When we, isn't that, there's something there, huh? Like, when you see the light from a question that you had missed and now you get it completely, there should be like this relief from that, right? A release of frustration potentially from reviewing your mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think Nate probably needs to be a little more diligent, right? It ain't no try to get an hour of study every day. You need to block that out on your calendar, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk about an hour, but I want to make sure that Nate is focusing on what he does in that hour, which is maybe one question and reviewing it. I mean, presumably you can do more questions in an hour and review them carefully and understand them. But if the metric is, oh, did I do an hour? But you're just going through a lot of questions, or you're just doing a section and then seeing what score you got and then reviewing a couple of them, that's not a good hour. That's not the metric we're looking at. We're looking at the number of clicks, the number of realizations you get in that time. And so if that means you do three questions, but you get three clicks or six clicks, because you can get multiple clicks from one question.
Yeah.
That's a much better use of that hour than, okay, I did a section and then kind of like just glanced at
people. People should be looking for multiple clicks per question, because it took multiple mistakes for you to miss that question. I mean, you picked a wrong answer and you also failed to pick the right one. Those are two separate mistakes. And so in your review, like you might learn something from the wrong answer you chose. Why is this wrong? How could I have recognized that it's wrong? How do I avoid making this mistake next time? Be sure that you feel, oh, yeah, that makes that answer conclusively wrong. I can't pick that answer. And then on the right answer that you did not pick, what scared you off of it? Why didn't you pick it? Do you see now how it's the only answer that clearly answers this question? Do you see how, does it feel like the right answer? And so then there's potentially two separate clicks, not to mention all the mistakes that you might have made by misreading the passage or misreading the question, or there's other kinds of clicks and other kinds of places where you might have made sloppy mistakes. And yeah, you can really squeeze a ton of value. So I agree. You know, student A, let's say student A does one question in drilling, gets it right pretty easily. Does another question in drilling, gets it right pretty easily. Does another question in drilling and struggles. Maybe they miss it. Maybe they get it right. But then they spend the rest of the hour, again, reading explanations, watching video explanations, using the ask button to get clarity. And let's say that takes the whole hour, but the student gets a click or two. That's way better than hammering a full section and then not reviewing it, or hammering a full section and then like skimming the answers like, oh yeah, I see why D's a better fit there. Uh-huh. Yep. Next.
Oh shit. Why did I, oh, it's so frustrating. Why do I get that stuff wrong? It's like,
I always struggle on these necessary assumption questions. Next.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, wait a second. You missed that necessary assumption question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't need you going and like doing lessons now on necessary assumption questions. I need you to review that necessary assumption question.
Yeah.
What's it asking you? Why did you pick an answer that doesn't answer the question? Why didn't you pick the answer that is sitting there on the page in front of you that does answer the question? And you got to just be like more, if you're going to be frustrated, you should be frustrated about each mistake and then go review each mistake instead of just like looking at your section score and being like, oh, that's a lower number. That's really frustrating. Well, you can't work on that, but you can work on every single mistake you've made.
Yeah. And the research backs this up. I mean, there's a, you know, all these language programs now, they've shifted to, we're not going to teach you a bunch of rules about the new language that you're trying to learn. We're going to teach you a bunch of actual sentences. You start to learn how to say those sentences. You don't understand the rules behind them. But later, when they explain the rules, they're going to make sense because you have all these specific examples that follow that rule. And you go, oh, okay, I can see why it makes sense. Trying to talk about the rules and then apply that to specific examples is the opposite and least effective way to do this. You got to learn from individual questions, figure out, oh, okay, I can see why this is a necessary assumption in this question. Do that again. And then when someone starts talking about necessary assumptions in general, it's going to make a lot more sense because you have this background experience that informs that.
The best way to learn it is just through examples, right? Like, yeah, there's, yeah. That's why we don't lead with theory at LSAT Demon. We would rather you just, it says what it means. It means what it says. All the words right there on the page, if you read them carefully and you just think through what they're saying, then you should be able to unlock it without any like theory about, oh, this is a necessary assumption question, and on necessary assumption questions, they tend to work in this sort of a way. I mean, you'll get that in the explanations.
Mm-hmm.
But you also could figure it out for yourself. If I like trapped you again, you know, back to my escape room scenario that I talk about on the show kind of regularly, I guess. If yeah. I locked you in a room with this question and I said, hey, you have to answer this question correctly or I'm not going to let you out, you'd figure it out. I believe that. I believe it makes sense if you make sense of it. Mm-hmm. And that is our job. So once you struggle with it, then, you know, I'm not like I force you never to do, you know, like you can't ever have any help. No, I want to give you the help, but I want you to attempt it on your own. I want you to encounter, like genuinely give it your best shot first. And then when you make that mistake or those multiple mistakes that it takes to miss that question, then yeah, we got all kinds of resources for you to try to figure out that specific mistake before you go on and do more questions.
Yeah.
All right. I think we beat that one to death. You want to read this next one from Anonymous?
Yeah. Hi, Ben and Nathan. Any thoughts on online law school? I plan to apply to all online and hybrid part-time programs in my area, Los Angeles. I love my job at a law firm. I am the main breadwinner in my family, so I need my job to put food on the table, and I have a toddler at home. So online/hybrid part-time programs are the best option for me and my family. Are they trying to sell me snake oil? Do you think students can thrive in this online format of law school?
Yes. Live law school is a complete fucking joke. In 2023, there's no need for everybody to be going to campus. There's so much waste in everybody going to some hallowed grounds of learning. And law students are adults. We have been making amazing progress with LSAT students at LSAT Demon Live, which is just fully Zoom online education, for the LSAT. And if you can prep for the LSAT online, then you can definitely prep for law school online. So my hypothesis is that the education itself is probably better in these online or hybrid part-time programs. I mean, it sounds like you're probably going to get younger, hipper professors. It sounds like the resources are going to be a lot better. There's going to be so much. I mean, the fact that you can do it, you wouldn't even be able to do full-time in person and keep your job. Part-time law school is nothing new. Law school used to be predominantly night school. Way back in the day, law school was like, oh yeah, of course you're working and you're going and studying law school, at night. Great. But it never was this full-time, like, take 3 years out of your life just to go to the hallowed halls of legal education.
Yeah.
Educationally, yes, students can thrive online. Employment-wise, yeah, that's not what we're being asked here. I assume that Anonymous has, you're working in a law firm, you love your job. I assume you know lots of lawyers. Don't go to law school until you have checked this plan with lawyers who do work like the work you hope to do, and say, hey, if I go to, I don't know who you're talking about here, but probably LMU, probably Loyola Marymount, probably has a hybrid online program where, you go out to their beautiful ocean campus every other weekend, once a month, something like that. And then the vast majority of it is just online. What are the employment outcomes from LMU? I don't think there's any reason. Ben, there's no reason to suspect that online hybrid degrees from schools that have an established law school are going to be looked at any differently than the people who actually go to campus full time.
I don't think so. That's what I was just going to say. Do they even know?
No, I don't think they would even know. They're going to have, it's a JD, it's a JD. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think, are they trying to sell you snake oil? Well, that's a different question.
That's true for law schools. The thing I've been disappointed about with these online programs is that they're charging prices that are very close, at least from what I've seen, to their in-person programs, right? And it's like, hey, here's an opportunity for you to be disruptive, and they're not, at least in terms of pricing, but you just have to go back to the scholarship game. This is tough because there's not as many online options, and so maybe you can't find as many schools that are willing to give you a scholarship to do their online program, but who knows? You got to figure that out.
Yeah. And I think it's just inevitable that there's going to be more and more of this stuff. I mean, schools will try to insist that people need to come to campus in order to get the, they're going to, I really think the only reason why they're doing that is because they're trying to justify their huge tuitions and their huge expenses that it takes to run these giant campuses. But
there's also some ABA rules, right, about this that might be limiting their ability to do fully online.
Yeah. I mean, this is going to change. It'll continue to change. I think COVID gave it a bit of a kickstart, and now it'll just continue to seep in. Essentially, as old lawyers die, this type of thing will come to be fully accepted.
Yeah. The last thing I want to tell Anonymous is, you said, I plan to apply to all online programs in my area. Obviously, you have to apply to hybrid programs in your area, but if it's a fully online program, I wouldn't limit yourself to Los Angeles. I would look anywhere that has a fully online program.
Arizona has one
and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, and what if it's once a month? You have to go
fly out there
a weekend in Phoenix or whatever.
Totally.
For that matter, a weekend in St. Louis.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, right? If they're going to give you a good scholarship there, you're going to save more than you're going to spend on a few trips,
a few flights, a few hotels. Yeah, I agree. I think you might be able to broaden that a little bit if they're purely online, or if they're hybrid in a way that you only have to go, three or four times in the semester or something like that. It might work for a distance thing. Although, then again, if you're really going to stay and practice in Southern California, it probably makes more sense to just build your network in California and go to a California school.
Sure. This next one is from, yeah, this is from the Ask Button. You want to read it? It says,
greetings. I am completely lost on how to answer sufficient assumption questions. I'm picking out the conclusions, but when I go to predict the answer, nothing I am predicting is even close to the answer choices. How can I start from scratch with these questions?
Yeah, this is interesting because in sufficient assumption questions, if you are, I mean, there's this odd thing here. I'm picking out the conclusions. It feels like you're not doing enough. I mean, everyone needs to pick out the conclusions, not only in sufficient assumption questions, but in any question that has an argument. But there's more than just, oh, I've identified the conclusion. It's like, okay, what is the conclusion saying? What is the evidence saying? Does that evidence prove the conclusion? In yeah. these questions, it won't. But the thing about these questions is that when there is a problem, there is going to be a problem with the argument, but usually there's only one specific problem.
Well, the thing that the Ask Button correspondent seems to be missing is that they're not talking about the evidence at all. It says, I am picking out the conclusions. Well, first of all, there's probably only one conclusion. On a sufficient assumption question, we're probably going to have one or more premises, and we're going to have one conclusion that clearly this is what they're trying to prove. And it's not just, what's the conclusion? Let me see if I can predict an answer. It's, what's the conclusion? What's the evidence that they gave me? Now let me see if I can predict an answer that gets me from the evidence to the conclusion. That's the prediction. Like, there's a universal prediction, Ben, for sufficient assumption questions, which is, if the evidence is true, then the conclusion is true. So yeah. We'll do a real simple example, okay? I have a boarding pass for a flight that leaves today. Therefore, I will go to the airport today. Okay, that's my argument. Again, I'll say my argument. It's real simple. There's one premise and a conclusion. The premise is, I have a boarding pass for a flight that leaves today. My conclusion is, therefore, I will go to the airport today. Now, that sounds perfectly reasonable, right? I mean, you look at that and you go, oh, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Of course, if you have a boarding pass that leaves today, then you're definitely going to go to the airport today. But maybe not. I mean, maybe I decide not to get on the flight. Maybe I decide to change it. So yeah, that's absolutely the problem with the argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anyway, I'll let you make the prediction, but the prediction just for the real simple sufficient assumption questions. And that's what this correspondent's talking about, is like rebooting, starting from scratch on sufficient assumption. So again, I'll do my argument and then Ben, you talk through how to make the prediction. Okay. So my argument is, I have a boarding pass for a flight that leaves today. My conclusion is, therefore, I will go to the airport today.
Yeah. So when in your conclusion, you said, therefore, I will go to the airport today. And I'm thinking, although you're likely to go to the airport today, I imagine that the vast majority of people who have boarding passes for today will end up going to the airport today. I don't know that you will necessarily go to the airport today, because there are definitely some people who don't end up going, right? So that's one, identifying the problem with the argument. That premise, the fact that you have a boarding pass, does not prove that you're going to go. Therefore, I need something that comes in and fixes that and says, okay, anyone with a boarding pass will in fact go to the airport the day they have that boarding pass.
Yeah, or, it's basically, yeah, if the evidence is true, then the conclusion is true. So Ben's prediction was, if you have a boarding pass for today, that's the evidence. Mm-hmm. If it's true that you have a boarding pass for today, then the conclusion has to be true. You will go to the airport. So it's as simple as that. It's just like, what's the premise? What's the conclusion? How do I build that bridge so that if the premise is true, the conclusion also has to be true? So you just say, hey, if this is true, then the conclusion is also true. That's sufficient assumption questions on training wheels. You will encounter harder ones where there will be a premise that does link to the conclusion and another premise that doesn't quite link to the other premise. So sometimes you have to build a bridge between premises to make the argument really click.
I mean, you can talk about it in terms of, and that's totally true. It is like this if then sort of thing. But the only thing I'm hesitant about explaining it that way is that people can kind of get like caught up and not thinking about, okay, what's the actual argument here? And what is the problem? Why can't I get from this premise to that conclusion?
Right.
Right. And just because in some cases there's a jump between the two premises, or there's just even when there's the jump is small, it's like some nuance, and you can get that if you're really paying attention to the argument, but you're not going to get that if you're trying to just abstractly think about, oh, how do I get from this premise to this conclusion with an if-then statement?
Cool.
All right. Anything else to say for that?
Nope. Next one is from Anonymous. Subject is addendum for number of schools attended? RC Plateau, just thrown in there as an additional subject.
So okay.
Two subjects, I guess.
Yeah. Hello, Ben and Nathan. I was wondering if I should write an addendum explaining why I've taken classes from four different colleges. I took one class during high school, two during a gap year from another college, spent 2 years at a different college, went to play baseball too, and finally my last year at a different college for my bachelor's. Three of the four were community colleges. Last was a four-year university. Second.
Don't need to explain that at all. Let's talk about that first thing first. I would not explain that at all. It's obvious. If you have community colleges on your transcript and then you ended up graduating from a four-year university, you don't need to explain why there's multiple schools on the record. The degree is coming from that four-year university. Don't bother.
Okay. Second, I'm struggling with reading comp, finishing three passages with about -4 accuracy for those three.
Yeah, that's not great. That's more than half a passage worth of questions that you're missing on average, right? Passages have 5 to 8 questions.
Mm-hmm.
So missing 4 questions is like, you could be missing 4 out of 5 on the first passage.
Yeah.
And that's not good. Okay.
When I do the fourth passage after the section and time myself, I typically do well. Okay. What does well mean? So does it come down to speed? If I finished all four passages, my scores would be around -6 in essence, instead of around -10. Any advice is appreciated. Love the podcast. You're going too fast. Really, yeah. You want to do those first two passages and try to miss nothing. And then we can start talking about even doing three.
Right. You need to do one perfect passage. Then you can do the second passage, get that one perfect. Mm-hmm. Then you can do the third passage. If you get that one perfect and guess randomly on the fourth passage, you're already getting like -6. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you just clean up your mistakes, you're already around -6. It's much easier to clean up those mistakes than it is to try to do an additional whole passage. I mean, read the whole goddamn thing and answer 5 to 8 questions about it and not slip up even more on your accuracy. I mean, I promise that if you try to go fast, if you try to cram this all in right now in 35 minutes, you're not going to get to -6. You're going to get to like -12 because you're just going to make even more mistakes. I would focus on perfection. People always think that like -4 accuracy for three passages is good. But what it really means is that there's 8 questions that you don't really have. You know, there's like probably 8 questions that you kind of felt like were a 50-50 and you got half of them right and half of them wrong. I mean, you're skimming the surface. There's just way too much that you're not understanding. So yeah, I double down on Ben's advice that you just need to slow down and focus on perfection. Eventually you'll get faster if you learn how easy it is. But right now you're skimming the surface and making it hard for yourself.
Great. The next one is from Kate. The subject is undergraduate GPA trends and predictions.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I'm planning to apply to law school in the 2025 cycle, and I'd love to know your thoughts on if we think there will be a trend in declining undergraduate GPA medians. I, like so many current and prospective law students, was a college student during the COVID pandemic. My college gave students the option to pass/fail individual courses versus entire semesters. My UGPA is pretty good. I'm a STEM major with a 3.92. Jesus Christ, that's really good. But it could have been higher if I pass/failed some classes instead of taking the letter grade. Of course, that's behind me now. But do you think we'll see a trend in declining UGPA medians a few years post-pandemic grading policies? I imagine a large chunk of the high UGPAs came from these policies. I'm taking the LSAT now. I'm planning to take all the remaining LSATs with games. But do you think I would have better luck for scholarships at top schools if I waited for UGPAs to possibly go down? And does that matter for an applicant with a GPA like mine?
Interesting. So basically, COVID helped people get higher GPAs. It hurt them, but they ultimately got higher GPAs because of the policies that were put in place. They were too generous. It's kind of like accommodations on the LSAT. Too generous.
Right. Well, and then Kate thinks that they might be coming back down. You can see law school's historical GPA numbers at lawschooltransparency.com. Some schools haven't changed much, like Yale just really hasn't changed dramatically in the law school GPA. But others have changed dramatically. If you look at like UCLA, their LSAT is up by like a few points, but their GPA is also up by like a tenth of a point or more over. But that's over like 10 years. That's over an even longer time frame. Producer Eric points out helpfully that the New York Times did some recent reporting on grade inflation. And Ben, I don't know if you had time to take a look at that article, but I pulled out one quote from it. It just says, Yale's cluster of A's and A minuses has been rising for years. In the 2010-2011 academic year, 67% of all grades were A's and A minuses, the report found. By 2018-2019, 73% were in the A range. That figure spiked during the pandemic. In 21-22, almost 82% of Yale grades were in the A range. So yeah, that is like a 10%, 9% increase, basically like right at the pandemic. Last academic year, the figure was about 79%. And so that actually dipped down, but it only gave back like a tiny bit of that COVID gain. And when you view it as not just a COVID bump, but you view it as this longer term trend of grade inflation, I don't think Kate has any reason to suspect that the UGPAs are going to go down in coming application cycles. What do you think?
No, I actually agree, because I think what's happening every year and every generation is that people are becoming more and more competitive in these established fields, right? Like elite education and so forth. I mean, even just going back to when we were applying to undergrad, I don't think it was as competitive. I think more and more people are just saying, oh, okay, this is how the game is played. That message is getting passed down to younger students, younger kids, right? Like the lessons, quote, we learned is just compounding. And so I think that forces people to be more competitive, trying to get higher grades, get help, as well as schools trying to compete in this market and inflate their grades. So there's these other pressures that I think will continue to push things up.
I mean, one continual pressure is if you give students A's, they're happy. If you give students A's, their parents are happy. If you want happy alums, happy graduates, happy current, you know, if you want donors to your school, if you want your undergraduates to be competitive in things like law school applications, there's just all these incentives that push in the direction of just giving A's. Grade inflation is huge. I don't see it going anywhere. I think you should ignore the COVID spike and instead just assume that grades are probably going to keep going up everywhere.
Yeah. You also just think about the 509 reports and how close all the different grades are, especially at the top.
Oh yeah. I think it's only ever going to go up, Kate. I do have a tip for Kate. Ben, I'm surprised you didn't catch this, or maybe you did. Kate says her UGPA could have been higher if she pass-failed some classes instead of taking the letter grade.
So,
of course, that's behind me now, she says.
Yeah.
What do you say?
Yeah, appeal it, for sure.
Totally appeal it. Even if you only have a 5% chance. We've had stories on the show of people like putting on their lawyer hat and, you know, really like getting in there with these schools. And in some cases, getting policies totally changed, you know, but it might be as simple as, hi, school I went to and did really well at and loved and have all these great connections with. I'm applying to law school now and I'm really regretting my decision. You know, my law school GPA is being held back by the fact that I didn't pass fail these classes during COVID. I don't know how you want to craft the appeal exactly, right? But it's like, it's a COVID thing and it, you know, it's just, yeah, I don't know. What do you say? I was going to say, yeah, I was sick and I forgot to put it pass fail. I don't know.
You know, I mean, honestly, what I would do is I would put the argument down. I'd say what you want to do in ChatGPT and see what random arguments it comes up with and then pick the ones that are the most persuasive or the one. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Kate, if you do that, please, you know, email us back or go to our website, thinkinglsat.com, and let us know how that goes. But it is possible that you could get that higher GPA on your record if you just go back and ask your undergrad, see if they'll somehow change that to a pass instead of a B.
Yeah, that would be huge.
If they're ever going to do anybody a favor, they should do you a favor. You're killing it. You know, you killed it. You clearly did really well there. The rest of your record backs this up. And your case is along the lines of, hey, I'm applying to law school now. And I just didn't think that this was going to be a problem. But boy, I wish I would have pass failed these nasty STEM classes that I had the opportunity to pass fail. And my cohort did. And now they have a higher GPA than I did just because I stupidly took this, you know, B plus that's lowering my grades. Like, can you change this B plus to a pass? Why can't they change that B plus to a pass? They're going to have policies and whatever, but then you see if they'll hear your concerns and then maybe they make an exception. That's what a lawyer would do. See if you can get that exception.
Yeah.
All right. Brad writes in and asks about applying broadly.
Hello, Ben and Nathan. I currently have a 4.0 GPA and a 170 LSAT, applying as a K through JD next fall. I really want to attend the University of Texas Law because I'm from Texas and I want to practice big law after graduation in the state of Texas.
Sounds okay? Like a plan. Yeah.
Got Texas there in well, three times in one sentence.
And it's a 4.0 GPA, a 170 LSAT, Texas native, wants to go to UT, wants to practice big law. That all sounds like a pretty rock solid plan.
Yeah. I hope to apply to about 10 schools, and I'm thinking of applying to Baylor, Texas A&M, Duke, UVA, WashU. What other schools would be best to send applications and hopefully get something I could use to negotiate with the University of Texas? I am not against going to another school if the offer is better, but not sure what schools in the T14 would give me a competitive offer.
Well, that's too easy. Go to lsatdemon.com/scholarships. Put your 4.0 and your 170 into our estimator and hit calculate or whatever that button says. Estimate, it should say. And you should get a prediction about, or not a prediction because it's backward looking, but we're looking at what a 4.0 and a 170 LSAT did for you in the last application cycle. And that should give you lots of ideas about what kinds of schools might give scholarships that are right around the range of Texas.
Yeah. And also, though, in the T14, I don't know, Brad, you have good numbers. Why not just apply to all of them? I mean, it's not cheap, but who knows what you're going to get back.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a scholarship offer to negotiate with UT, right?
Yeah.
It's give yourself the best walking away point you possibly can, right? And if an admission to Harvard or Stanford or Yale comes in, Those don't have to be scholarship offers. You just go, hey, I got into actual Yale Law School. I do want to stay in Texas, but for my family, the financial prospects for my family, I think I'm going to take this offer from Yale.
Yeah.
And see what they say. If they haven't already offered you the gigantic scholarship that you're deserving.
Or maybe they're giving you a full ride, but they decide to give you a stipend. I don't know if the University of Texas does that, but when they're thinking that just the fact that your name is now associated with Stanford or Harvard or Yale or even Chicago or Michigan, they're going to perceive you as more valuable and maybe want to give you more money.
Yeah, I think you need to apply to UCLA, which is right around the same ranking as Texas and gives big scholarships. I think you also need to, I mean, you've already got UVA on your list. That's great. I would add multiple other schools in the top 14 and see what kinds of offers you get.
Okay.
Thanks, Brad.
Yeah, last, we got two sentences here for word of the week.
Vocabulary corner. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are both from me. This first one says, Alex had lived in Spain and later France in an itinerant spiritual community, but had decided to leave. The word itinerant was the one I looked up. I mean, it has the word, it sounds like itinerary. So it sounds like travel, but I just wanted to confirm, like, what the hell does that actually mean? And itinerant means traveling from place to place.
Yep. I've heard it refer to farm workers. Sometimes people talk about itinerant farm workers. Okay, cool. Great. What were you reading when you looked that up?
That was the New York Times. Okay. I read like the first few paragraphs because I was just like, wait, they found a kid who had been lost for 6 years? Like, that always kind of blows my mind. Like, how does someone get lost for 6 years and not be dead? Like, it seems like that long, but this kid had gotten into this community. So
yeah. Okay.
The next one was TK's, and that's referring to Travis, I think, Callahan. I don't know his last name, actually. The founder of Uber. TK's rapacious strategy at Uber drove the company's aggressive expansion. And rapacious, I was curious what that meant. And that's aggressively greedy or grasping.
Yeah. That one, you know, trigger warning, sorry, but rapacious starts with rape.
Mm.
And so, you know,
is
I don't know.
Is that the base word?
Have no idea if they're the same, but every time I read, the way that word is used is always about, it sounds like, you know, it's like raping and pillaging. This sounds like pillaging, aggressively greedy or grasping. So yeah, like taking.
Yeah.
Ben was looking up the etymology, I guess.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I'm just curious.
Find anything.
Yeah.
Or
okay. Rapid apparently is one of the base words. Moving or doing quickly. Obviously that's what that means. Which comes from Latin, rapidus, hasty, swift, snatching, fierce, impetus.
I think it has to have something to do with the origins of rape, right? It's like, it's like right now, take it right now, you know? And that's, even if it's not
that
etymology, it's still useful for figuring out.
Apparently, rapin, which is seize, prey, abduct, take, carry off by force. So maybe they're different. I don't know.
They sound very similar. I don't know. If anybody wants to chime in, those words seem rooted together. Anyway, even if I'm wrong, that's an example of where kind of just looking at the word itself might give me some ideas about what the word turns out to mean. It could just be like a happy accident, or it could be because of a common root. But the combination of looking at the word itself and the context, TK's rapacious strategy at Uber drove the company's aggressive expansion. It's like, well, what other kind of strategy would drive the company's aggressive expansion besides greedy, aggressively expanding? That's what the word probably means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. That was
all
Vocab
right.
Corner.
Yeah. If you have any words that you looked up this week, let us know. Email help at, no, actually go to thinkinglsat.com. Nathan, you don't have any words?
Not this week, no. I mean, you always put some on the agenda, so I haven't added any, but I'll keep an eye out this week.
Okay.
I'm reading a book right now I've literally looked up like 50 words in this book, just the beginning of it. The book is called Cloud Atlas. It's fiction. I'm not sure if I'm going to make it through. It's a tough slog so far to even follow what's going on. Multiple different narrators and stuff. It's just difficult reading, but it's got lots and lots of vocabulary. So I have been happily looking stuff up as I read.
Be LSAT famous. Please ask us questions or share news with us at Thinking LSAT. If you have questions about LSAT Demon, email help@lsatdemon.com. You can also check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. This is new. Subscribe on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. That was episode 434 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.